Hello and welcome to Enemies of Good Art. The title of today's show is Big Society, where we will look at ideas around networks, communities and David Cameron's notion of a big society, mainly considering a demographic of women in London having children with little or no family support, and in particular the massive art community in the East End, but it applies to London as a whole. Can we in fact support each other, or has state intervention caused the demise of civil associations? Is David Cameron's big idea whitewash for the financial hardship we're about to face, or does he genuinely believe in autonomy and self-determination? Can the government relax certain bureaucratic measures that control our daily lives? I'm Martina Milani from Enemies of Good Art, and I'm joined on the phone by Lina Duvarovic, who is the co-founder, and director of Electro Productions, a London-based contemporary art agency which specialises in curating, commissioning and producing ambitious multidisciplinary projects across artists working with sound, moving image, performance and the visual arts, nationally and internationally. They have worked with most of the major public art institutions in London, including the Tate, Chisholm and South London Galleries. In 2006, Lina was named the Decibel Mid-Career Curatorial Fellow by the Arts Council of England, and she is also the single mother of a 2.5-year-old son. And in the studio, hi Lina.
Hi.
And in the studio, I'm joined by Paul Halliday, who's a sociologist, photographer and filmmaker based in the Centre for Urban and Community Research at Goldsmiths University, where he is also the course leader of the MA in Photography and Urban Cultures. He studied social anthropology and art history at Goldsmiths and Oxford University. Originally trained in photojournalism and fine art film, he has worked with Channel 4, The Guardian, Independent Magazine. He is also former media advisor for the British Refugee Council. His main research interests are urban photography, visual ethnography, sociology and cultures of art practice, ethnographic and experimental film. He completed a 20-year photographic project in 2006 about London street cultures and is currently completing a photographic project around global cities. Josie Appleton is the convener of the Manifesto Club. She oversees the club's campaigns, publications and accounts, and as a writer and journalist, she writes on freedom issues of the day for a number of publications. The Manifesto Club campaigns against the hyper-regulation of everyday life, supporting free movements across borders, free expression and free association. They say we challenge booze bans, photo bans, vetting and speech codes, all new ways in which the state regulates everyday life on the streets, in workplaces and in our private lives. We believe that the freedom issues of the 21st century cut across old political boundaries and require new schools of political thought and new methods of campaigning and organising and organisation. She heads the campaign against vetting, a subject we will return to later. But first of all, I thought I'd ask the panel what they think about David Cameron's notion of a big society and what it means to them. And perhaps we could start with you, Josie.
I think it's once something becomes a policy buzzword, it becomes almost immediately both emptied of meaning, and then everyone also shoves their own meaning in it. So I think rather than talk about what I think about David Cameron's idea, I guess I'd like to talk about what I would want from big society or from a good society. And I think that what really has been lost over the last 10 years of New Labour is the ways in which people organise things together. So at an informal neighbourhood level, just the number of state obstacles are put in the way of people wanting to put on a boys' football match or to share childcare or to have a poetry reading in a pub. You know, essentially you require state clearance for the most everyday activities. And so for me, a much freer society would be where you actually did have civil society, i.e. people just organising things for themselves. And actually you never have to fill in a form and you never have to get any kind of licence. But the concert happens and people go home and that's that. So I think that actually it'll be difficult to underestimate the scope of the problem, I think, in terms of state regulation of civil society. And so I think that would be a formidable challenge to essentially build forms of resistance to tackle those different forms of intervention and actually create some genuinely free spaces, which wouldn't be like a harking back to the past and, kind of the old style pub or anything. It would be new, very much new civic spaces, but where essentially people have put the thing together themselves. There's no liability insurance, there's no CRB checks, but just people getting together and organising it and getting the benefits for collaboration with each other.
Okay. Paul?
Well, I'm somewhat confused by the notion of big society, because it seems to me that it's a kind of reformulation of Margaret Thatcher's idea of there being no society, but instead actually bringing to it a kind of ideological fig leaf. And I'm sort of interested in terms of how the Conservative Party have actually managed to redefine what they mean by a concept that they actually initially debunked several years ago, somewhat famously in Margaret Thatcher's speech. I think what's also interesting from a sociological point of view is this idea of society versus community, and that's maybe something that we'll talk about later. Ferdinand Tonnies, who's an old sociologist who used to work around these ideas, sort of made a distinction between what he called Gemeinschaft, which is the idea of community and the idea of belonging, the idea of investment and these sorts of things, and Gesellschaft, which is the wider concept of society. And it does seem to me that what Cameron's trying to do is to claim Gemeinschaft, which is very much about saying it's all about belonging, it's all about having a sense of investment. And that's actually quite a touchy-feely approach. It rings very well. It's a very, very good soundbite. It's the kind of thing that you can imagine a focus group would sit down and say, well, okay, we've got a fig leaf that we know we're going to have to put over the cuts. How can we actually develop that fig leaf to actually seem plausible and tenable? So I suppose my approach to big society, in terms of my understanding of how Cameron sort of formulated it, would be to say it's essentially ideologically driven. It comes at a very convenient time when we know that we're facing massive cuts across education and the arts. And it does seem to me that it's a very useful way of actually disguising what's about to happen, which I think is going to be a kind of economic bloodbath.
Right. Lena, do you have an opinion on big society?
Well, very similar to what we just heard. I mean, to me, what really seems to be impossible to do is to read and think about the big society without reading it through the lens of the recent cuts. And I think when you destabilize people's sense of individuality and people's sense of investment in themselves and their futures and their own communities through simply taking away the kind of basic structures that they're surrounded by sort of stripping away so much of core infrastructure of society that we know today, and then kind of, on the other hand, at the same time, it's all fine because you're going to be empowered and it's all going to be great because you're suddenly going to be all hands and working together to create something better. I don't see how the two can go hand in hand. I just don't see how this can happen. I think we're all feeling so destabilized, and people are genuinely worried on a very, very basic level. So how is this? How are we supposed to work on these notions that are, I mean, I'm looking at the big society document, and I'm just not really, I don't understand how the two are supposed to work together. It's so obvious to me that they are actually a complete contradiction in terms.
And the document you're referring to is the document from the Cabinet Office that I sent round, which outlines the government's ideas around how big society could function.
Yes, building the big society.
My own personal opinion on big society, which is why we're here today, really, is for very much from the point of view of someone who's very interested in the idea of community as a subject. And I think Lena can very much identify with some of the things I'm going to say in terms of why I'm interested in it. And the return to the idea of community as an ideology, of course, it's a wonderful thing. We'd all love to be able to live in a society where we knew we were being loved and supported by those around us. But as a foreigner to this city, and Lena is also, at times it doesn't necessarily feel like that's a possibility. And I know that the city as a phenomenon is something that you're quite interested, Paul. And indeed, Josie, the idea of community and what holds us back in terms of forming community is something that you have campaigned against. or for, I should say, in terms of the case against betting. And I'm talking about a community where, and I talked about this on the last program that I hosted, and I talk about it when I host public meetings with enemies of good art. The idea that we could support each other as mothers and artists or parents with children. Mostly it concerns women, because mostly women have engaged with enemies of good art, but nevertheless there are men who do also. Where we could support each other and take each other's children and care for each other's children and love each other's children, like our parents did. But somehow, I've been trying to set this up with neighbours and friends and colleagues of mine for over a year now, and I can't seem to get it to work, and I don't know why. And I'm interested in the reasons, and I'm thinking it has something to do with the fact that we are so regulated and used to being regulated that we don't know how to form ourselves as civil groups. And perhaps this is something that you could expand upon. And in terms of the campaign against vetting and how important that is and what that impact that has had upon us then.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very much state propagated idea that you can't trust anyone unless they have official clearance, so unless they have their pass saying that they're safe, unless they've been on, you know, the child protection course, this course, that course, and that essentially just any old person on the street, that they're implicitly dodgy and they need to be checked out before you can trust them. Mm-hmm. So I think that this has really undermined people's capacity to organise together in various ways. And one of them is definitely childcare, because it, like you say, it has always happened. It's not rocket science. A lot of mothers at home who, if you ganged up, you'd have the kids one day in five or one day in four, right? And the rest of the time you would have free, and you wouldn't have childcare costs, and you wouldn't necessarily want to send to a state nursery. So it makes a lot of sense. But I think that there has been an undermining of people's capacity to self-organisation, because you actually can only trust, or you can only take a particular role if you have some kind of official qualification. Another thing is like people's capacity to intervene in public. You know, So it's like you can't. If some of the kids are kind of playing up a little bit, people don't think that they can intervene. It's like you've got to call the council. He's got to issue an ASBO, or he's got to call up the talking CCTV to tell them to, you know, stop kicking the can around or whatever. You know, it's like the more official community representative the state creates, the more it undermines real communities. So the more it gives out badges to people to say that they're neighbourhood wardens or CSOs or whatever, then the less actually normal people can do those very important things. And so I actually think that big society, as Cameron puts it, rather than as I would want it to be, is an extension of that new Labour state intervention in society. Because he's talking about big society days, big society banks, big society, you know, national citizen service. You know, all these are actually forms of state-created community. Like, actually, the real big society would be if you had an event and the state had nothing to do with it. They didn't pay for it. They didn't vet it. They didn't tell you what day you were going to have it on. They had nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And that would actually be a genuine civic day. But what every single thing that they've talked about, like, is Cameron is supporting civil society. It's like, no, don't support it. Just remove some of the restrictions and people will organise, because they have needs, which, as you do. You have a need, which is to organise childcare for your children. Other people have a need to organise football for their children. Or a need to have a street party or a party or put on a theatre production or whatever. You know, we have these needs, and if we don't have things in our way, then we will do that. So I think that the best thing that state could do would be to remove the restrictions, and also remove a lot of the kind of poisonous propaganda it produces about how you can't trust anybody, and then people will be freer to actually create those sorts of civic spaces and collaborations.
I know that you, Paul, and Lena, you're both parents. How do you feel about that in terms of the state relaxing some of the bureaucratic measures in place in terms of our fears around other adults and who takes care of our children?
Shall I go first?
Sorry. Yes, please, Lena.
Okay. Well, I do feel it's extreme. I do feel it's extreme that to even leave your child for a moment with somebody, you kind of actually feel really good that you haven't seen this person. And what happened to just basic old sense of kind of getting a sense from the person, whether you trust them or not? I mean, there is something in that as well. And I mean, I've left my child with child minders who haven't been registered and haven't been CRB checked, and people have said that I'm, you know, a terrible parent. But, you know, they were absolutely fine, and I'm not saying they always would be, but it's just this sense that you just actually can't trust anyone, and the more you think about it, the less you trust yourself and your own instincts, and that's what's really dangerous, I think, that we're sort of stripped away of what our genuine core sort of instinctual reaction might be to another person, because, you know, we haven't actually gone through 10 different procedures to make sure that you know, someone else out there has put a stamp on them as an okay person to look after your child. But what I think is to me really disappointing in London is that I don't know how we would get. I mean, you, Martina, have been, to me, very successful in actually organizing and getting people together. From my perspective, I live in a shared house. I live in a building with four flats, three of which have small children between 2 and 5. I believe my neighbor is also a single parent. I don't actually know that because she doesn't say hello to me. None of us communicate. And my upstairs neighbor, I hear her little girl running up and down, and my son is in our living room, yet there's no kind of basic communication. And to me, what I think, Martina, you're achieving with your initiatives has gone so many steps beyond what I can even dream of, which is to maybe actually share childcare for 2 hours. So to me, I just don't know how to go about it. I mean, I've gone down the very official route of having my child in full-time childcare and paying through the nose for it.
So it's not that you're opposed to the idea of others looking after your children, it's just that it's almost an impossibility to set that network in place.
I feel that it is, and I also feel that we're all so busy solving our own problems that we would never actually sit down and talk about some shared issues that we could actually help each other with. I think partly it's maybe because London is such a transient place and such a sort of place where people may only be in one particular address for a certain amount of time and then move and all that, but partly it's also coming from this sense of regulation that you need to be keeping in mind when you're solving a very simple problem like how to go to the shop for half an hour while your child is looked after by somebody else.
And Paul?
Well, I was thinking that this partly relates to the idea of place as well. I mean, we're talking about my interest in walking around and photographing London, various other cities around the world. But I was thinking about partly my own biography in terms of my geographic biography in terms mm-hmm. of where I've lived and where I've moved. I grew up in Greenwich. I grew up in a place called Plumstead, which was formerly a sort of village, and sort of London sort of grew onto it. And certainly my childhood, I had a very, very strong sense of there being an established community. There was an established network of friends, family, and also family. My grandmother lived about 200 metres away from our house. My uncle and auntie lived very close. My sister moved very close as well. I had a great aunt lived just down the road as well from my sister. So there's a really strong sense of there being a geographic locale. My parents had lots of friends as well. So from a very young age, I walked to school from about 7 or 8. I would imagine that it would be almost inconceivable that a child of 7 or 8 would be allowed to, certainly the area that I live in now, which is Clapham, I'd be very uncomfortable with the idea of my daughter's now 10, but the idea of her when she was 7 walking to school on her own unaccompanied would be impossible.
Why?
Partly because of the situation around roads, partly the situation around there not being a sense of community in the way that there was a sense when I grew up. And that's not sort of harking back to some sort of, you know, imagined halcyon moment in urban living. It was actually something that was actually very real and very, very experienced for me. Mm. And it's also something we talk about now within the family. My partner and myself, we talk about the way in which London has changed as a landscape, as a sort of an urban cultural landscape. So I think that there is this sort of sense of a shifting sense of safety, but also a shifting sense of belonging, and also to some degree a shifting sense of collective responsibility as well. And I'll give an example of this. As I moved around, being a photographer, I've, you know, worked in various cities around the world, and I spent some time in Greece. I spent some time in Athens and on a couple of islands as well in Greece. And one of the things that really struck me there was just how clear people are about getting involved in childcare. there's a real sense of the extended family, but also the sense of village or the sense of community. And a good example of that would be the first time that I saw a child who was crying in the street, and I think it was the father, leant over and smacked him on the legs. Lots of people appeared from nowhere and gave him a lecture. And they said, you cannot do this, this is not acceptable, etc., etc., etc. And it wasn't, there wasn't a sense of they're intervening inappropriately. There was a sense of them saying very clearly that they had a sense of concern for that child's welfare and safety. And that was something that I saw consistently around Athens, that people were prepared to articulate their views, they were prepared to get involved. And consequently, it meant that there was also a sense that children felt safer on the street. And I felt that. I stayed on Skiros, which is a wonderful island in Greece, for about 3 months as well. And you would see what I can only describe as sort of bands of children wandering around the village, wandering around the beach areas as well. And adults would know them. They would keep their eye on them. They would report back to other adults they knew that were in some way associated with them, which either had the effect of being a kind of, as it were, very, very simple form of CCTV, which may or may not be a good thing. But what it did provide was a sense of, I think, of security for those children, but also a sense of freedom, because it wasn't just that they were being observed, there was a real sense that they were being looked after as well.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Very much feels like in London that we must mind our own business.
Yep.
And would anybody care for your child on the way to school in Clapham if something were to happen?
Yeah.
Could you rely on society or the community around you to actually care about what might happen to her, or if anything happened?
Well, that would be my worry, because it's not. I mean, there's a kind of an inner. There's a. I mean, how can I put this? There are different Claphams. There's a kind of an outer Clapham. There's a kind of an inner Clapham as well. And I think the people that have lived there for some time. My partner grew up in Clapham. Her parents live in the area as well. So she's got a very extensive network there. I've lived in Clapham for 12 years now. So I feel that I'm sort of just about starting to become part of that network. But I think it's true to say that a lot of people on the street are very transient. They're people that move in. There's an area which has a very high number of people that work in financial services, in banking, these sorts of things, who tend not to stay too long. So they tend to be there for maybe 3-4 years and then they move on. So there isn't really, I think, a sense of belonging in the way that I experienced Greenwich, in the way in which I experienced Plumstead as a child. And that's my fear. It's about the fear of sending out a child and not knowing that people would be prepared to intervene if something were to happen.
Well, if you can talk about the childhood you had and the sense of community that you had. And I had it also growing up in the West of Ireland. And I know that the West of Ireland now is not considered to be the safe haven it used to be. And I know that my nieces and nephews don't have the freedom I had, even though there are still people living in the same houses they've always lived in. But somehow there's this cultural fear that surrounds us that means that perhaps my nieces and nephews don't roam across the countryside like I did and my brothers and sisters, or up and down the road like we used to on broken bikes, because somebody's afraid that something's going to happen, but we don't exactly know what that might be. And so this notion of fear that seems to be instilled upon us in terms of a society seems to govern us to a degree. And I come back to the idea around vetting or the case against, and you, Josie, in terms of what that means for us, because there are some pretty ridiculous scenarios in place that the government are trying to push forward in terms of what we must adhere to in terms of CRB checking and other governances that make sure that somehow we're okay. Then does that then inherently affect us as individuals? If we know that we're expected to be checked, do then we perform in a different sort of way?
I think that CRB checks came out of a particular cultural climate, but then they helped to create it as well, and it's a kind of feedback dynamic. CRB checks really, we so accept them as part of life, but really they were very, very rare only in 2002, and no other country has a system we have here. If you try and explain it to a French person, they don't understand the idea that you would need state clearance before you volunteer at your daughter's nursery. So it is very much a system that the UK alone really has developed, and it very much came out of a particular where you had a lot of panics around, you know, child abuse and people feeling more worried about other people. And I think a lot of social anxieties play out in relation to children because they're these symbols of innocence. And so I think that the idea of other people having ill intent plays out in relation to children more than anything else. And so CRB checks really started as a product of this environment and this culture, but they then helped to create that culture again, which is to create the culture of what am I allowed to do? You know, so essentially, you should only trust someone because they have a piece of paper. Anyone who doesn't have the piece of paper, you shouldn't trust them. And so what that has kind of meant is that people think it's safer not to do anything. Mm-hmm. They think it's safer to not actually stop and help a child who isn't their own because they don't have all the qualifications and what people will think they're a paedophile if they stop and help. And so, you know, a scary number in surveys, a scary number of men said that they wouldn't stop to help a child who was in trouble. You know, and you're talking like 20-30%. And there'd been a number of cases of there's one girl knocked over on the road and several cars drove around her before someone stopped. You've got instances of essentially child neglect now that would not have occurred, that would have been thought unthinkable. Children being left alone after practice because all the child protection codes, child protection they're called, right? But child protection codes say you must not take a child alone in your car. So the obvious thing that you would do if there's a 10-year-old after football practice whose parents haven't turned up is to say, I'll give you a lift home. But all the child protection codes say you should not take... It's a risky situation for you to put the child in your car and take them home. And so you end up with a situation where it's safer to leave the child there in the dark, in the rain, on their own. And that's happened. So I think that essentially you've had a kind of bureaucratization of that whole basic caring relationship, whereby it's almost like the whole thing's flipped upside down. So actually, normal, decent caring is seen as potentially risky, and what is safer is to withdraw, which obviously leads children more vulnerable. And then that actually means that parents have a certain good reason to not want their children to go out on their own, because if 30% of men wouldn't stop, then you know, then essentially your child is more on their own. So I think that there is a kind of... all these bureaucratic measures came out of a certain fear that was growing at the end of the 90s. Mm-hmm. But then every single one of them helped to recreate that fear in double the form. So that we ended up in really quite an unusual situation in the UK. I think that a lot of the forms of state regulation in the UK have parallels over Europe, but this particular one is really quite... quite specific to here. And I think that has to do with maybe a number of things to do with the family being much more of an isolated unit here. And, you know, the kind of less of an extended family, the 70s and 80s and that kind of thing. But the only countries that have a certain similar culture are Australia and America, but no other country has institutionalised it in the way that we have. So I think it very much came out of a very particular period. But every measure that they brought through to protect children had the absolute opposite effect, which was to create more alienation between decent adults and children, and to actually isolate children from potential sources of help.
And Lena, in terms of your experiences of London and other places that you lived, because I know you've lived abroad as well, and and you're Serbian, how does it differ from where you grew up and your experiences?
Well, I mean, very much what we've heard from everybody. I mean, where I grew up, we were running up and down the streets in a big gang of, 5, 10, 15 kids from age of maybe 6 or 7 to sort of young teens. And everybody was perfectly happy for us to pop into somebody's house or garden and then somebody else's. And of course, you're aware of traffic, but beyond that, and this is... You know, this is a capital city. This was Belgrade in the 70s, and it's a completely different sense. But I just now, while people have been talking, I've been thinking, and I really do think it's something to do with the fact that we all knew pretty much everybody that lived on that street, and we'd known them for probably a generation, or, you know, we knew that they would be there for another 10 or 15 years. And now, even now, when I go back, I get an update on so-and-so who is now married and so-and-so has had a kid. So people come and stay and build their families there. And to me, that's probably the biggest difference. Of course, now Belgrade is a much less safe place than it used to be for obvious reasons. But I still get a sense of kind of much more of a communal way of looking after children. And what I personally really suffer from in London is the lack of any family, and that's another thing that's to do with this kind of place where people come and sort of live for a little bit and then go somewhere else, but where, by at least for me, I'm completely alone. So the whole notion of it takes a village to bring up a child is really something I believe more than anything, but sadly can't do anything about. But what I have found, just to kind of say something positive too, is that I have been able to sort of create a sort of surrogate family or an alternative family with close friends. So it's not about kind of pooling together with other parents or anything like that, but two very close friends of mine, who are my son's godparents, have been probably better than any father, not any father, but many fathers. His godfather was there when he was born, and he looks after him very often, and he picks him up from nursery, and his godmother, who works with me, is amazing. And to me, that has given me some hope that at least I feel that, okay, maybe we don't have this kind of traditional family. That's maybe sort of dissipating, but there are possibilities. There are at least I kind of have a little bit of hope in these kind of alternative groupings, because we are not all living in nuclear families with two grandparents each side down the road. So, you know, I have had good experiences in this very, very close group of people.
Which brings us back to that idea that you were talking about earlier, when you say that we have to trust ourselves and our own interests, and be confident in the choices that we make, because once we have this culture of fear put upon us, then we begin to question ourselves. But it brings me also back to what you were talking about, Paul, in terms of community and society and Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, and what that means now, and indeed, you know, the hope that Lena talks about in terms of there being positives, but as in an alternative for how we can attain that, or we can live in a much more agreeable place. That is London also, because I think London is particularly harsh in terms of that sense of community and society, and in particular community.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it comes back to this idea, doesn't it, of how you actually facilitate Gemeinschaft as well. And it does seem to me that Cameron's big plan, big idea, is very much based on the idea of reformulating, redefining Gesellschaft, you know, the bigger idea of a, you know, a wider society, but thinking of it or sort of framing it as being very much about locality. The problem with that is it carries with it an inherent contradiction. If you look at the document, and I've looked at it a couple of times, I had a chance to read it on the way in as well. Basically, it's talking about responsibility, it's talking about transparency, it's talking about any number of buzzwords like decentralisation. So actually, in terms of its political economy, it's effectively driven by the need to create small state. And that means really about taking resources away from local communities, away from charities probably, and away also from local authorities. Although it does actually say that it wants to give local authorities more say in the processes of deciding. But of course the thing is that if the resources aren't there, in terms of how that's then played out, if you're talking about trying to foster a sense of locale, a sense of community, a sense of Gemeinschaft, I wonder how that will happen. And it struck me on the way in that maybe really what we're moving towards is a form of very selective amateurism, which is actually about thinking in terms of groups of people that can actually try and do best with what they've got. Now, I'm not sure about that, because as someone that actually works within a professional education, higher education environment, where I run a master's programme, I think you can take well-meaning amateurism so far, but also fundamentally you do need to have resources, and you do need to have people that understand the disciplines, that understand the things that they're teaching. You need to have resources on the ground, and I think that's going to be one of the big issues about how this new formulation of society, in Cameron's term, actually plays out. So I think it's sort of early days. I think that at the moment they're still working out what they mean by society. But I think very, very shortly we're going to see the impact of that, of those particular ideologies on the ground in terms of education, arts and other related areas. Not sure if that answers your question.
I'm not sure. I'm wondering about something about ideas around our passivity also, and how passive we are, and how accepting we are of some major issues that have taken place in terms of the erosion of our civil liberties. Okay, that started with New Labour, but I can't see that the Tories are going to roll back that one and let us all be free again, which essentially is what David Cameron is trying to con us with, some, because it feels like a big con, this whole big society business. And that somehow he's going to, you know, make us all free and liberal, and we can form any associations that we want to. But yet, I can't really imagine. And Lena's ideas that she was talking about as there being an alternative, perhaps an alternative structure around the family. And I've seen it myself in China, where the one-child policy has really meant that as people know that they can only have one child, they really come together in groups. Where there aren't siblings, there are big groups of friends.
I think there is this idea of conviviality, and the idea that you can actually make networks, you can actually work with people, you can share interests, you can have a shared sense of community, you can have a sense of investment. I don't dispute that for one moment. Mm. And I think that localities, I think communities that work well are essentially convivial communities. And I was thinking, again, on the way in, of an example of that. I was thinking about Deptford High Street a few years ago. I saw an elderly man. Deptford is a pretty diverse, mixed community. There's lots of West Africans, Caribbean, Asian people, Vietnamese people living there. And I saw an elderly white man, probably about 75, something like that, who'd collapsed on the street. And I was struck by the fact that the first people that went to his aid were two young Caribbean boys. They were probably, I'd say, about 15, 16. One of them was on the phone to the ambulance, and the other was checking his pulse. And
were they wearing hoodies?
They looked like Deptford young men, basically. I mean, I can't remember if they were in hoodies. I don't think they were. But anyway, the main point really was that there was a real sense at that moment. I mean, a lot of people saw that, and you could sort of see the look in people's eyes of, this is a fantastic place to live. Because in that space, and in that moment, it sort of summed up for me the idea of Gemeinschaft, the idea of community. They didn't know him. You could see that they hadn't met him before. They didn't know who he was. But there was a sense of them being invested and belonging and taking some sort of action. I mean, when I saw him go down, my initial reaction was to get across the road to help him. And for me, that was just wonderful. And that made me realise just how special Deptford was and is, continues to be, as a place. If you go to Deptford High Street on any market day, you'll see that sense of conviviality, people out in the street talking, a sense of who they are. I mean, I don't live in Deptford any longer. I lived there for 7 years. But when I go back, people still know who I am, and people will come up to me and talk to me. I lived in Chelsea for 4 years. I can't say I had the same experience there at all. It was an entirely different place to live. So I think it does come back to this idea of place and space, locale, investment, and the kind of networks that people actually can develop. And I don't think that they're actually necessarily developed by people saying, right, we're going to have a big society day now. Right, today we're going to send people out to bring in people, to get a sense of, you know, who they are, and to come to a local community centre to develop this sense of community. I was reading again the document. It said something about there being a special training for community organisers. Mm. Now, I wonder what that's going to entail. Does it mean you sort of cite? Does it mean you have to be a member of the Liberal Party or the Conservative Party to become a recognised community organiser? How does that play out in terms of the fact that there are already specialist courses for people that are community workers, youth workers, community education workers, adult education workers, etc., etc.? But what's interesting is that hidden in the document, it talks about, quote unquote, a new generation of community organisers. And I think that that's fundamentally driven by this ideology of change. It's a kind of utopian idea that what we need to do is break from the past. We need to bring in a new set of trained specialists who are in some way going to facilitate a new, bigger society. So it's kind of slightly, and I hesitate to use the big O word here, but it is slightly Orwellian in its scope and its breadth.
I can hear you agreeing, Lena.
Yes.
I can also think that in terms of our passivity and how passive we seem to be. I know the French, the recent strikes all over France in terms of the age for retirement going up from 60 to 62. Well, there's talk of it going from 60 to 65 here and indeed 70. And there hasn't been a strike or a murmur about it. Mm. And the French are all over the country having, you know, a really important debate about this. Are we somewhat more passive-aggressive, and in particular in London? Do you find that, in all the campaigns that you manage to support, do you find that generally people are willing to engage or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to campaign on issues that people care about, or else you're just kind of sounding off. And so, I mean, I think that when we do campaigns, we very much aim to find the issues where there is a community of interest, a constituency of interest that has been brought up against the state, and people are really fed up about it. And I think that then is the basis, a kind of raw material where you can actually organise a campaign, you can, you know, develop ideas about the issue. You know, so we're vetting, you know, a lot of people are having a really hard time with it, and we're really angry with it about the whole situation. Similarly, on the regulation of alcohol, really strong constituency, which just doesn't see why they should be told exactly how much they're going to drink, what their beer should be called, what size their glass should be, how much it should cost, what the queue should be like in the pub, you know, all these things that officials have essentially regulated. So I think you have to have a constituency that's fed up. What's interesting is the different issues that become flashpoints in different countries. So in France, for example, there's very little reaction on the regulation of alcohol. There's more reaction on the banning of the burqa. But like you say, it was the retirement issue that really struck the chord. And I think that every country essentially has its flashpoint issues, the things that of all the 100 things in the world that affect your life and that are a source of limitation for you, what are the one or two that essentially for you are an issue of political consciousness and really kind of light the fire in that country? And I think they're very different kind of across Europe. But I think that England is very much developing a kind of new populist vocabulary of freedom in opposition to the degree of state intervention we've had in this country. And so I think that there is a kind of recognition. You talk to anyone, you know, on the bus, in the taxi or whatever, and there's a kind of regulation that we are overregulated, things have gone too far, etc. I think that the Tories had recognised that and saw that as being a potential something they could key into. I mean, I very much agree with Paul that the kind of content of this is, I mean, it's like Stalinist, okay? It's called, you can have a big society day, national citizen service. I mean, why don't they have a big society parade, big society badges, you know, big society flags? I mean, you know, the people's people's party or something. I mean, you know, all this stuff, it's just total. The idea that the state can name a day and say this is society's day, you know, it's just kind of see through, and it's been done so many times, and very much established part of authoritarian regimes that it kind of
perhaps they need to establish a St. George's Day before they let everybody else celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I think that the good things that the coalition has done in terms of abolishing ID cards, abolishing the child database, potentially abolishing the vetting database, we'll have to see, very much hoping they do. You know, they have made quite important important changes. My concern is that it's a question of liberating people from the old regime and reinstilling a new set of controls for the new, like you say, a new generation of community organisers. We don't want Labour's community organisers, we want our own. We don't want Labour's issues, we want our own. Essentially, new forms of contact and new forms of state influence over society that are not the old way but the new way. So as long as it's just, my concern would be that they're just essentially getting rid of things with a new Labour stamp and putting things that they've got their stamp on. But actually the content is in some ways the same. I mean, looking through the actual plans of big society, it's pretty much nothing that doesn't have some kind of parallel from New Labour. You know, National Volunteer Service has been suggested 100 times under New Labour. You know, kind of citizens are always kind of getting more involved in your communities, that kind of stuff. You know, there's hundreds of policies that are about that sort of thing, essentially state-supervised community action. And devolving to local authorities, law after law with New Labour essentially gave local authorities new powers to to essentially actually control their citizens in new ways, to have dispersal zones, to have no drinking zones, no lifting zones, no dog walking zones. And Labour would say that they were decentralising and empowering. Actually, they're empowering the local agents of the state. And I think there's a lot of sign that the Tories are doing that as well with licensing. They've given licensing authorities new powers to refuse licences and close down pubs without actually having any kind of hearing. So they've actually given licensing boards really, really overweening powers to say who can open a pub, what the conditions are on the licence. So you might actually have a licence with a condition saying you have to have door staff searching the bags of your customers, or a CCTV camera in your pub or outside your pub, which was a condition of one Islington pub owner. So essentially, in terms of the things the Tories are concurrently doing, they're in many ways empowering different parts of the state to have more control over people, or empowering state-sanctioned community activists. So, I mean, I think that the stuff that they've rolled back has been very good, but the stuff that I'm worried about is the stuff they seem to care more about, which is the whole kind of actually for extending the state in new ways over civic life, which is a double whammy with the cuts. You know, you cut. You cut back useful public services, and then you have some community organiser coming around to your door asking you how they can help you. And it's just, it's like, well, you know, actually, a decent housing benefit would be what I'd want, but, you know, you have essentially state-sanctioned do-gooder to intervene in communities. So I think that it goes very much along with the cuts as part of, you know, part of the same agenda, really.
Well, in this speech, in his Big Society speech that he gave on the 19th of July in Liverpool, he talks about Big Society and describes it as being a society where people in their everyday lives, in their homes, in their neighbourhoods, in their workplace, don't always have to turn to officials, local authorities or central government for answers to the problems they face, but instead feel both free and powerful enough to help themselves and their own communities, which suggests in a way that we have now the freedom to be able to look after each other's kids if we want to. Mm. And therefore, we don't have to worry about being CRB checked. And I met a dad in the park on Tuesday, and turns out that he's a freelance furniture maker, and he's looking after his daughter now while his wife goes to work. And so I talked to him about, and I was looking after my friend's kid, and I was like, well, could you manage these three little girls? They're all under the age of, between the age of 2.5 and a year and a half. And so we talked about the logistics. And first of all, he said to me, how many kids am I allowed to have? In terms of how many kids is he legally allowed to have in his house before he gets checked or somebody, you know, tells on him or reports him. And I immediately thought, that's awful. I couldn't care less, personally. And I'll have as many kids as I can shove into my house so that I might get a few free days of childcare and I'll have to pay for it. And also, it's a nicer experience for my daughter to have kids around her of people that she knows. But this was his reaction. So we're talking about it. So we'll see if it comes off. But somehow, and to come back to you, Lena, is it much easier just to go ahead with the you know, we live in a free market economy where we travel a lot, where we have the means to pay for things. And so is it easier just to pay for, and I know that your son has been through a few nurseries, is it easier just to do that than have to go through the rigmarole of trying to form that network that could help you out? And then in some way have to passively, aggressively break the rules and try to get away with it?
Yes, well, I did find that when I tried to go down the sort of less formal route, it took a lot longer. And it took, there was a lot more organizing and a lot more kind of stuff for me to do. I did have a nanny share at one point and things like that, and it was just so complicated. It was like a part-time job, basically, and I just felt that was something I could do. I mean, it's also, I mean, for me, and just a personal opinion, I do actually really like the idea of my son going to nursery because of the learning part of it. So now he's almost three, and I think to be maybe with a bunch of kids of my friends would be fun occasionally, but I think it's actually a really good thing. I think he thrives at nursery, and that, you know, that is something that I think each parent decides for themselves, but I've made very kind of conscious choices to actually send him to nursery, because I know he will come back knowing, I don't know, learning things. There's a certain structure to the day. There's a certain structure to there are certain milestones that they're trying to reach, and that I actually feel quite strongly about. I think it's really good. So if that was taken away, and if he was kind of just, basically he would just be playing with cars 7 hours a day, and I'm not sure that would be so great.
No.
So you know, it's also, once you sort of form these networks, then it starts to be about how does it actually work, and, you know, how much energy these people have and all of that. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't be prepared to do that. I would, but it would, it takes a lot more, I think. So it's I don't know. I've gone down this route, so.
And I'm trying to go down that route because I can't afford the childcare. But in terms of the idea of volunteering, which Big Society seems to talk about quite a lot, and we could all help each other out in that respect. If by volunteering certain services, and I volunteer to take care of my friends' kids as well as my own, and they likewise reciprocate, then surely I'm taking away a wage from someone who could be getting paid to look after our children. And so if we volunteer and the volunteer sector becomes more prominent, as is supposedly the case, then and the idea of subsidised nurseries is a big issue that we could spend all day talking about. But if we, so that it is affordable to send your children to nursery, and so therefore that part of the economy keeps going. But if we volunteer, if we try to do what Cameron is asking us to do, then surely we're taking away valuable services that the government can't or no longer are willing to fund, and therefore we're putting other people out of work, and that in itself then causes its own issues and problems. But in terms of community, it seems like it should work in terms of us giving up some of our time to help other people. But I'm wondering how that can function, especially, and I keep coming back to London, especially in a city like London that is so vast, that is fast, that is very difficult to navigate on any level. And therefore, I'm not sure that it's going to work so well within London. And I'm wondering, Paul, how you feel about the idea of the possibility in terms of community, where somehow we're being forced to take care of each other, because now these facilities or these arrangements that were once provided by the government will no longer exist. And so therefore, if we're forced in some way to perform as a caring community, then surely we can't be, because it's something that's false.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very good point. What exactly is volunteering? I mean, what constitutes volunteering? Is it a conscious act? Is there an act of intentionality about it? You know, do I say to myself when I'm about to go and spend some time at my daughter's school or facilitating something that I am now volunteering? Or is it something that's much more intuitive? And I'd suggest that people, especially people who've got kids, when they've got young children, they tend to think in terms of not so much volunteering, but they just think in terms of spending time with their children and the networks around them. I'm on a management committee of an arts group called Photo Fusion, which is a photographic education gallery project in Brixton. I don't think we really tend to think in terms of it as being volunteering. We tend to think of it in terms of putting something back into the community. And I'd say that most people that are actually the arts community, but also the local community and the regional community, and to some degree the international community as well. Mm. And I think that most of my colleagues and friends that are on that committee put an awful amount of time in, an incredible amount of time in. But we certainly don't think, you know, of looking at our diaries to total it up and to think in terms of quantifying it in some way. So it does seem to me that, you know, one of the shifts that needs to take place is redefining what it means to actually spend time in the community and spend time putting time into the community as well. And it comes back to this idea, this central idea, I think, this German idea, this Germanic idea of Gemeinschaft. I know I keep saying that word, but I think it's so important because I think it has connotations, it has resonances, which are to do with place, to do with space, to do with investment, and to do with belonging as well.
Mm.
The problem with Cameron's...
Go on. No, go on. I can remember it.
The problem with Cameron's view, I think, of or formulation of volunteering is that it becomes bureaucratized. Now, there is some talk, I know, of there being some way of actually recognising volunteering in some way, whether that will be through sort of some sort of brownie point system. Maybe there'll be a volunteering medal. I don't know.
It's been talked about.
Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I mean, there's a kind of logical trajectory there, which is really about when you quantify it, when you recognise it publicly. And I'm sure there will be big public events. There'll be a recognition of, events where the great and the good will come and shake hands with the people who have actually done an amazing amount of volunteering hours. So I think it's less about quantity and more about quality, but also about how do you get to a point where people feel invested enough to want to put time into their communities.
Okay.
And that's not necessarily about volunteering.
And no, and that's a good point. And I think, Lena, it's an important point for you and I, because how do you feel invested or feel a sense of belonging? Especially when you don't belong to this city. And I'm not sure that there are many people who feel like they belong to this city in particular, because of the fact, well, for various reasons. We have a huge international population in London. And I think that even Londoners who've been brought up and live here don't necessarily feel that they belong anymore.
Mm.
And so that sense of belonging, how can we attain that? And the other thing, and perhaps Lena, you might like to respond to this, when are we supposed to volunteer our time?
Exactly.
What time, and how are we supposed to make more time to volunteer it? Could you imagine, as a full-time working single mother, that you could give up any of your time? What time would you be able to give up to volunteer?
Of course not. I mean, to me, it all comes down to very practical matters, and when I was reading these documents, I was really thinking that's exactly what constantly kept coming to my mind. Yes, but when? But when?
Yeah.
Because I think this is again related to the economics of it all, because, you know, the more unemployment we have, the more, it's not to say that people are going to stop working and just go volunteer in the community, because it doesn't work that way. We still live in London, and London is an incredibly expensive city. So it's all well and good to think that, oh, okay, let's go part-time, or let's you know, kind of try and be more useful in the community, but work less, well, that's nice, but it isn't actually going to pay the bills. So at the end of the day, I think that, to me, this is kind of a, I feel like I'm going round and round in circles and chasing my own tail, because there's never going to be enough time to improve the amount of time to spend more time with my child and kind of connect to other parents and do those things that in theory I would like to do, and that would help that sense of belonging. And the more I work, the less time I even have to kind of actually think about those things. So I don't have an answer, in short.
The two documents, I should say for our listeners, that we're referring to is the Big Society speech by David Cameron in Liverpool, on the 19th of July earlier this year. And that can be accessed through Number 10 website, and also the Big Society document released by the Cabinet Office, and it can also be found on the Cabinet Office website, which sets out how Big Society might function. And those are the two main documents that we've looked at for today that we refer to. But we are running out of time, and it's somehow, if we could just comment on the idea of, if we're being forced to volunteer, which I've talked about before, and we rack up these points systems, which are being talked about, and there are two local councils, I can't remember exactly where now, that are coming together so that if you to pool their resources, like many councils are, but their idea is that if you volunteer, then you rack up points, and then you could go and spend them in the high street. So there's a monetary value involved. But surely that goes against the grain of this loving, caring, happy society that we're all supposed to be part of, if we're going to in some way then get some sort of monetary value or compensation in return. So it's all another whitewash. And it seems to me like, I know we're all quite cynical about this notion of big society, but our hands are being forced to a degree. I don't know, we have a minute to for any parting comments we'd like to make. Josie, are you...
I mean, I think there are communities in London. My brother's wife is Mexican, and there's a very, very strong Mexican community. I think a lot of different cultures who've come here have very strong support networks, Jewish networks, that kind of thing. I think there was a problem with mainstream London. In New York, there's a mother who organised an initiative called Take Your Kids to the Park and Leave Them There. And what she was saying was that essentially her kids... she told them to go outside and play, and they said there's no one outside, and she realised that was true. And so she was basically saying, look, kids should have free time in the park, and they should play with each other, and they should meet new friends and that kind of thing. So I think there are there is a kind of common awareness in cities of a kind of desire to create new spaces for collaboration and that kind of thing. And she had a very positive reaction there. So I think a similar thing could be possible here. And, you know, forms of collaboration that you don't trust someone because you know them, you trust them because they're probably someone like you. I think that the cities have always worked on that assumption that you can trust strangers and kind of ways of being civil to people you don't know. In the countryside, if you don't know someone, it's like, who are you? You're a foreigner. But the city, you don't know someone, you think you're someone like me and I can talk to you.
Paul, we have to... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm being told we have to go. Just very quickly... Sorry, Paul. Now, very quickly, our show next week is on feminism. And Irene Revelle will be joined by, among others, Jude Kelly, the director of the South Bank Centre. Thank you.